that's the key here. If you're starting something new, really got to find the people who are not just there to sell you something because they think it's good, or maybe they just need the money and they're just trying to sell anything that they've got. You've got to be really careful about that and not get caught up in trends or fads, which that certainly was a fleeting one there.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. What's up, Ryan?
Hey, Tate. I'm broadcasting live from our golden office in Colorado. So excited to see you. Excited to connect.
Excited to see you as well. Yeah, it's been a busy month. I'm in almost through simulator in the 330, going from 8 years in the left seat back to first officer of the year, hanging up my check airman reins and going back to the ultra senior wide body FO life.
That sounds like upgrading to me.
I couldn't be more excited.
Congrats.
Yeah, I could hold captain on it, but man, I am excited. So focus on more real estate, fly some fun trips. I'm really excited about the change. It was time.
That's great. Well, I just got back from skiing in Park City with our investor ski retreat, and a couple of Hawaiian pilots were there, actually, so we missed having you.
I know. I wanted to be there, but I was busy doing V1 cuts.
No, that's right. That's right. Well, cool. I'm excited about the guest today. It's actually a doctor, dentist, former dentist, I should say, who runs a financial education group for other doctors, and that's kind of where the show is headed. So, you know, when I met Dr. David Phelps, I immediately thought, what a great guest to have on the show to kind of expose what the doctors are learning about in this industry and how they're acquiring knowledge and investing and expanding the horizon. And I think David has an awesome story, number one.
He does.
And, I think we talk about this in the show, but it's like one of those things where you don't really think you need to get something going on the side, but man, did it pay off for him. And we're going to have him tell the story. So, Tate, tell me about his background a little bit.
Well, he's got a quote on the bottom of his bio that resonates really, really well with what you just said. The greatest risk in life is doing nothing. And I just love that. It's so true. So David is the founder of Freedom Founders. It is a dentist group that helps other logical, rational professionals become dreamers, then strategically manifest those dreams into freedom. Under David's leadership, Freedom Founders mastermind community grows exponentially year by year, providing a pathway to freedom for many professional practice owners. So I'm really excited to get to the show. We talked about a gamut of things. So anything, any parting thoughts before we jump in?
No, I'm excited to get into it. Let's get to the show.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
David, we met about just prior to the turn of the new year. And what the way we got connected was you actually run an investment kind of education group for doctors. And I thought this was so interesting because we're basically doing the same thing for pilots. You know, right now it's kind of a blue ocean market. There's not a lot of people providing unbiased and unfiltered education for, you know, all things investing. You know, we're not necessarily focused just on alternatives or stocks or things like that. So it's really just a pleasure to have you. You know, but before we get started, if you wouldn't mind, kind of tell the story about how that came to be and how you kind of found yourself, you know, helping educate doctors.
Yeah, well, like you gentlemen, I started in a professional career. Mine was into the profession of dentistry, general practice dentistry. But before I even got my license to practice dentistry, I was started real estate. I just had this bug in me when I was in college about trying to learn how to be a good quote investor. I liked the term. I thought investment sounded good. I had no idea what it meant really. So I read books about stocks and bonds, and really back in the I'll date myself here, but it was really back in the late 70s when I was going through college, and I read some books on stocks and mutual funds. Mutual funds were just coming out then. And well, that's interesting, but it couldn't really make a lot of sense out of it. And I read some books on real estate. A lot of people refer to Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Well, that was not mine. Again, dates me. I know that book, and Roberts does a really great job of telling the story about why we like tangible assets. But for me, it was actually a book written by a great author. He's since deceased, but his name was William Nickerson. He wrote a book called How I Took $1,000 and Turned It Into $1 Million. Then it went to $3 million, then to $5 million as version 2, 3, and 4 came out. But essentially, it was about real estate. And I have that book on my shelf. In fact, I have an autographed version. And when I was reading that book in college, it just hit me that I liked the fact that with real estate, you had a tangible asset over which you could individually, if you wanted to, exert some control. And I think the three of us here, and probably the people who are listening to us, like control. That's why we do what we do. We want to be in charge. We want to be piloting that plane, so to speak, figuratively or in your case, literally. And so I jumped right out and found my first capital partner. Well, who's that? Well, usually it's family and friends. And yes, in fact, it was my father. So, hey, Dad, I got a great idea. I'm going to be going to school here. That's back in the day, in Dallas. When I was going to start a dental school, I said, you know, I can just like everybody else, I can pay rent and have an apartment, which would have been fine. Just kind of following the crowd. I said, why don't we, keyword we, invest in a property together and I'll manage it and you could put up the money. And because I had no money, I had student loan debt and no credit and no way to come up with even a down payment back in the day. So I'll keep the story short. We went through and found a property and I did manage it for the next 4 years until I graduated dental school. And I was moving on a little bit further away so I couldn't, you know, manage the property. So we sold it and we split about a $50,000 capital gain profit on the house. And back in 1983, that $25,000 was a big chunk of money for me. It's a decent chunk today. And I took that, my capital, and I kept learning and reading books and getting more of an understanding about how real estate could be what I call today a plan B wealth building plan. You know, dentistry is going to be my career. That's going to be how I make my money. But I just always thought I need to have this alternative plan, like just in case, or something that I felt like was going to build something. And I didn't really see how it was going to work, but I understood the basics of real estate enough at that point. I go, there's something here. And so I took that $25,000, my share, and parlayed that into multiple properties because I had to make that money work for me. You know, you guys talk a lot. We understand the power of leverage. Of course, it cuts both ways, but I understood enough about how to use it, I believe, correctly. I didn't stub my toe and built up a portfolio primarily of single family houses. And then I started learning the debt side or private credit side of real estate, which is also fascinating, and creating notes, buying notes. And that just went on from there. So I was doing dentistry and kind of my side real estate investment gig together. And I did not enjoy becoming a father until I was about 36. My wife and I got married when I was right out of dental school, but she had a career that she wanted to go into becoming an estate and tax attorney. Not attorney, excuse me, CPA. CPA. And I was, you know, building my dental practice. And so we actually did combine forces and did some real estate together, which is kind of cool. So we decided not to have a start a family until we kind of got settled. And our daughter was born. And then 2.5 years later, she's diagnosed with high-risk leukemia. And that just turned everything upside down for our little family at that point. Just you don't know what hits you at that point because you don't have any training for dealing with that kind of thing. Our daughter got through it, which was the main focus. But our marriage, unfortunately, didn't make it. And that's just a no-fault situation. Anybody who's gone through any kind of a hard, devastating personal health, financial, whatever crisis probably can relate because it's just tough. You don't know what hits you. But the good news is, our daughter survived and we co-parented her. She's now 30, going on 32 years old. So this is a 30-year story at this point. I went on and, you know, got back on my feet because going through a divorce settlement and then the emotions of all that, it's pretty tough. But I knew enough about what I was doing with real estate. And the key thing, and I think we brought it up here at the very beginning of the show, Ryan, you and I didn't meet just because we were on the internet searching for like cool guys to talk about real estate. We met through a mutual friend. You know, our network, it's huge in business or alternative investments because the inefficiencies of the market allow for inside information, right? We can have that in there. And so where do you get inside information? You call it from the other people you know. And so we were introduced by someone with whom we have great respect. In fact, he's been on your show a couple of times. I checked and saw. I'll just say, you know, Mr. Derek Long. Love the guy. He's super sharp. So we connected with Derek. And I'm spinning out here a little bit. It's going back to network. So the key thing I knew was I had a network that I built up over the years in real estate. So repeating my game plan to, you know, kind of pile up assets and snowball down the debt. I could do that again much faster the second time because I had kind of start over again when you split all the assets and I kept the real estate And it means I had a lot of debt. I had legal fees to pay. You guys understand. But coming back out of that, it was so much faster the second time from a financial standpoint.
Right.
And I think that's a—
because you had the income.
And you had
the knowledge of the network.
It was the knowledge of the network. Yeah, the income, certainly, that's a base. But I could do it faster because I had the knowledge and the network. So right. I could get back out and just move faster. So our daughter survived that leukemia bout. And then she unfortunately went through some issues with epileptic seizures, which were not very well controlled. So she's always taking medication. It was just— and then so 4 years after that, after she got through the leukemia, so now she's age 12, she's in end-stage liver failure. So all the chemo, all the seizure medication, just was caustic to her liver, and the liver was no longer filtering blood. It was actually causing blood to pool in her stomach that should have been going through her liver. And actually she was— I'll just keep this light, but you know, basically regurgitating blood out of her stomach. It's kind of a scary thought when you see your kid doing that. It's not a good sign. You have no idea what's going on, right? I mean, is her aorta, you know, what's going on? Why is all this blood coming out? So fortunately, they controlled it and put a band around her esophagus, which is where the bleed out was coming, to temporarily hold things together until, by the grace of God, 2 months later, we got the call, and she got the call that another child, unfortunately, met their demise, but their parents had set her up for organ donation. So our daughter and probably many other kids were the recipient of that child's organs, which allowed our daughter to live, and I'm forever grateful for that. So that was the point when she was 12, and this was 2004. Well, yeah, 20 years ago this year. My gosh, 20 years ago.
Nice.
And I'm sitting in the hospital, you know, after her transplant. She's in recovery mode. And I'm sitting there just watching her breathe. You know, she's sleeping most of the time, as anybody would after major surgery. And I'm just watching her breathe. And that's what I really had to think hard about. Well, what is my position here now? Yes, I need to be financially sound for my family. That's important. But is it also maybe would be good for me to be there? I mean, I was splitting time between, you know, my dental practice and being at the hospital. So back and forth. It was tough. And I just made the decision right then and there that I got to make a change. Well, that's good for a dream and a vision. I'd like to be free and just, you know, be able to spend time with my family. Who doesn't want that? But then there's the logical, rational side that we all have. It's like, yeah, but I mean, there's a piece that I have to put some pencil to the paper and put some math behind it. Does this logically going to make sense? So I decided all I really need to do is I want to buy some time, not retire, not be financially free for the rest of my life, but could I buy some time? And I did what I tell my people today in Freedom Founders is I just did back of the napkin math. I didn't have a spreadsheet. I didn't have my laptop open. I just basically could knew in my head what was my current asset, my current equity in my properties. What was it paying me net? And when I added up, it was enough. It was enough to set me free for, I thought, maybe 18 months. And to sell my practice too, because I had to let that go. I couldn't be responsible for both. So sell the practice, take one I had, take that equity, because I could put it back into assets again, because I knew where to put it. That was another key. I knew where to go. And combined, I thought, okay, I can at least float this thing called being financially responsible for at least 18 months. And I could go back and do another dental practice. I could be an associate somewhere. I mean, all kinds of ways to go. So I thought, this is it. I'm doing it. No looking back. And so I did. And then I never went back to dentistry. Why? Well, obviously, the time away, it gave me a margin of, I guess, looking at my life from different lenses and creativity. And then I had other doctors who I knew who didn't ask me, why did you leave your practice? They got it. Your daughter. Yeah, I get it. But the question was, how did you do it? Because I didn't share what I was doing with real estate all those years. I didn't share it with people. It wasn't part of cocktail conversation. It was just on the down low for me. And when I shared it with, you know, just a handful asked me, and I explained what I did with real estate. They said, well, you know, could you show me how to do it? I said, well, yeah, but if I take you back to how I started doing it when I was single and then married, but with no children, I said, that's probably not going to fit your game plan, because that was really more active involvement. Now today I'm much more passive, but back then it was active. So really what we did then, it was coming out of the 2008 financial crisis and, you know, you could pick up any kind of property asset on a discount. So they became my capital partners on really no big deals. Really, I was still just doing mostly single family. I had a mobile home park back then, but that wasn't part of this process. And they came as my capital partners. I'm talking about like five. Probably we co-invested together probably over $5 million. And we ran, you know, from 2009 to about 15, 16 when we exited those properties. I mean, we doubled the equity and everybody made out really, really well. And as a result, I had more people coming through these people, the doctors, say, well, hey, can you help me too? And then I had to decide again, well, am I going to like build us another business around this? And I really thought, gentlemen, I thought I could, but do I want to? And I decided I don't want to do that. And do I need to? And I thought, well, wait a minute. I've been doing this for decades. I know a lot of people. Back to network. I know a lot of people who actually have good business operations that either do single family houses or they need to borrow money. Or we were starting to look at what you gentlemen do is like, you know, larger properties, multifamily, self storage, where there was you find good operators. And so I knew people out in the space. We just hadn't put anything together. And I said, well, I'll just take a dozen or so doctors who are interested. I said, we'll just do a meeting. We'll just come to a meeting and I'll just share what I know and I'll bring some other people that I know and we'll just talk through how this might work. And that was the origins or the origination story of Freedom Founders back in 2010. So 14 years ago. And it just, you know, like you gentlemen are finding it, it just grew over time to a community today that is just a lot of fun to be kind of in the middle of it, but not actually doing the operations. I want to be passive in my investments. I really don't want to go out and be on the ground anymore. I've been there, done that. And that's a good place to be if you want to learn. But today it's like, who do you know? And how do you kind of vet the best opportunities? All right. I gave that to you there as tight as I could.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being vulnerable and sharing that personal story with your daughter. And it's just, it really kind of reminds me of like why we do this in the first place, which is, you know, we all love flying and not all of us, but most of us love what we do. It's a great career. It's a great profession, but you just never know when lightning is going to strike and you're going to have this situation in your life and you're going to say to yourself, I'm really glad I had this other thing going on that is going to give me the opportunity to get some breathing room and live with the situation that I'm in, right? And I think that's what this is all about. You know, this isn't necessarily the way to 50K at a time your way out of a job, right? To quit your aviation career that you've spent 25 years or 20 years in. This is really just a skill that you're teaching people that they can then take control of their investments. And I think that's what is driving us. So, you know, shouting from the mountaintops is podcast and, you know, more things that we're going to roll out later this year is just these types of things in your story. And, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, you go back to the intro episode in this, you know, Tate and I come out and we say, listen, this does not exist for the pilot and the flying community. And so we are that source. And, you know, the doctor community has this, right? They have Freedom Founders and they have a place to go to where they can learn about financial education as it applies to their business practice, you know, their practices, it applies to their alternative investments. And it kind of gives like a whole strategy. You know, I guess my first question really is thinking back, you know, because we're kind of in that same spot to where you are, what would be the one thing you would tell pilots, you know, sort of taking a step into this education space and, you know, being a platform to educate? What are some of your biggest takeaways that doctors didn't know that are high income earners that maybe they need to know, you know, and kind of saying it more to the flying community at large?
Yeah, well, it's the same, I think, for any professional or business class owner, high income, relatively high net worth. It's the lack of understanding of how you can take your capital outside of your business or from your career. How do you take that capital that you want to put into, quote, an investment? How do you make that capital actually produce income, replacement income? We call it, you know, cash flow, a passive or recurring cash flow. How do you make that happen? Most people never have heard of that. They just think, well, you put your money in a 401k, a savings plan, tax brokerage, and mutual funds, ETFs, annuities, whole life insurance. I mean, there's the whole gamut, right? But they're taught to accumulate as much as they can through these platforms. And then when you're ready to, quote, retire, then you look at, well, how much do I have here? What's the mountain look like? And how long can I make it last when I have to deplete it over the years, because really generating cash flow is not what you do in the financial markets. Usually you move from, you know, equities, you know, higher risk to lower risk on the capital stack to bonds or CDs or money markets, which are paying more today, but still probably not enough to keep up with inflation. So it's a depletion model. And when many of our doctors who have come to us and, you know, have had some form of financial advisor, and I'm not here to demean financial advisors at all. Look, I think there's certainly a place for advisors in different respects, but most of them do not understand what we do in the tangible side. They understand what they do in the financial markets, but they don't understand the same concept of, well, how do you take capital and actually put it in a platform, a base, an asset class that has predictability, some level of certainty, certainly more stability, and produces recurring income when you're ready to generate that recurring income. Now, if you're not ready to generate that, you can go into growth models when growth's appropriate, or you can do both. You can do a hybrid. You know, you guys talk about that. There's different ways to place your money. But just a tangible asset, most people understand intellectually that real estate has always provided a stronghold for creating and maintaining wealth over time. But most that are busy, where do you start? How do you do it? You go out there and you get in the craze of the recent, you know, short-term rental Airbnb stuff that people were like there after, during COVID going, hey, I've got this extra money. Let's go hit a home run over here. And there, you know, many of them didn't know how to buy right. So now they're stuck with high, you know, leverage, or just let's go flip some houses because, you know, our local real estate guys, they're just making money hand over fist. And they go out and get tripped up, and then they go, I can't do that. So I my dream's over, and I'll just have to go back to being a slave to trading time for dollars, and hope my 401k will get me there someday.
So David, I think that's spot on. You know, when people come to me and they say, hey, I've got $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, what should I do with it? And if they don't have any experience, I typically say, don't do anything with it. Invest in yourself. Learn. Yeah. You know, go to some conferences, listen to this podcast, listen to other people's podcasts, buy some books, because, you know, you can get infected with shiny object syndrome so easily in the real estate world. Let's go flip a house. Let's go buy this Airbnb. Ooh, mobile home parks look fun. You know, you need to understand the landscape, because the landscape is huge. And so understand the fundamentals, understand how can I participate in all these different ways? And then how do I want to participate intelligently? And that's where the network comes in. I love that you've created this network for doctors. To be frank, the genesis of my company was looking at folks like you at real estate conferences and thinking, why doesn't this exist for pilots? So Turbine Capital was born as a mirror image of what had already been built for the physician community. And as a follow-on, Ryan and I starting this podcast as an education platform, being, you know, the megaphone of, you know, hey, the community at large that Ryan and I are lucky to be connected with, to share those relationships and this knowledge base with aviators. So that's sort of why we're here, and I love it. Before we jump into, you know, the next topic at hand, I want to go back to something you said, because I ran some calculations. You said that you sold that, what was it, a duplex with your father back in 1983, right?
Single family.
Okay. Yep. So you made $25,000 on that. I ran it through the Bureau of Labor and Statistics inflation calculator, which I love. I'll drop the link to this thing in the show notes. It's a .gov website. This isn't some private company that does this. This is straight from the government. And if you had $25,000 in 1983, that has the equivalent buying power today of $78,400. So to give you an idea of what that did, and then what I think is more interesting is if you run the opposite calculation, if you'd have taken that $25,000 and stuffed it in your mattress, it would be worth $8,400 today. So that's the power of the erosion, really the negative power of inflation on your savings. And this is why savers get burned. This is the whole thing Robert Kiyosaki talks about, right? So this is why we love real estate, is because it's an insulator to inflation. It increases in value and protects you from inflation versus holding in cash. But anyway, we can get into all that stuff. What has been the best part of creating this network for dentists, physicians? Tell us more about Freedom Founders and the best parts of it, and why you've tripled down on it by leaving your practice and only focusing on Freedom Founders.
I didn't really have a vision for what it is today at all. I originally, as I said, back when I was just taking what I thought was going to be some time off to really focus on my daughter and be there for her, whether she was in the hospital recovering or she was well. I wanted to be there, right? Because I just didn't know if there's going to be more chances. So that was my number one focus. But in amongst that, you know, I had time to think and chance to help a few of these other docs. And really what it was for me is I got to see how it was changing the way they thought, their mindset, which I think is the nexus for everything we do in life. We grow up believing certain things to be true, whether they are or not. And many times they're not. It's just what's been transported to us either through parents or generations of well-meaning people, teachers, community leaders. Everybody has, you know, their thought process about, you know, what's the right way to go through life and go to school and XYZ, right? And there's so much that's not correct there that what I loved is just seeing how some of the docs, as they started to see how the power of, you know, the compound effect of some of the benefits that we and you teach your pilots and others about real estate is the light bulb start going on. Just like they did for me back in the late 70s when I was reading the books. It's just, and I know you guys talked about it on your intro podcast, is we didn't take, you know, any classes in school about entrepreneurialism because there wasn't any back when I was in school. There wasn't, I guess there were some classes on home building, but there wasn't anything about, you know, the financialization of, you know, tangible assets like real estate. There's not, and I didn't take any classes in economics or finance. It was, I just had to learn the stuff. And I was showing my group the other day. I had it sitting here somewhere. Oh yeah. I showed my tribe the other day, cause they wanted to kind of see what I was doing when I was back doing my, on the street. And I pulled up my HP12C, you know, a classic, you know, that, you know, I said, that's what I learned off of. I said, I was enamored by running numbers and seeing what I could do, because I was never a guy that really enjoyed or was good at, you know, the value add or flipping properties. I think I flipped one property in my whole investing career, and it worked out okay, but it's like, it was a lot of work, you know? And of course I wasn't scaled up to do it, right? I wasn't scaled to do it. So it's one thing if you're scaled, but I thought, well, I'll do it. And I realized, no, work out the financing. I can always put my money to work with somebody who is a really good operator and figure that piece out. So again, I'm kind of going around in a circle here a little bit, but coming back to your point of what do I enjoy? It's really the transformation of other people's lives. And it's not just the singular member of the household. And in this case, you know, of course, pilots and dentists are males and females today. You could have two breadwinners in a family. That's often the case. But seeing them come together as couples and getting on the same page about their financial future and a vision that actually they can start to see how it's going to play out. Not just to keep our fingers crossed that the financial advisor says, just keep plugging away at this. And we think we can get you there. What's there? Well, we don't really know. You maybe just keep doing it until you're burned out or you can't go any longer. And most of them go, well, that's not really what I want to have in mind here for my career. I'd like to have options to where if I enjoy what I do, maybe I can, you know, cut down the hours, or I bring in our case, we can bring in associate doctors or even partners. But scary to do that because again, we're giving up control, right? We don't want to give up that control. But when we have a financial plan outside of our primary income generator, our profession, then we can do other things that we otherwise be afraid to do. And that's the game changer that I see for so many.
That's so cool. Well, and this is the, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any means, but it's crazy to me as someone who started reading financial books as a teenager and has always been sort of, I had the bug like you did at a young age, that, you know, we're learning geometry and the Pythagorean theorem in high school, but you don't know how a trust works. You don't even know how a credit card works, how to write a check. You know, I mean, it's just, we are setting people up for failure. And I just don't know of how to fix that other than people who take the initiative and take it upon themselves to learn it through channels like this. So amen to that, and bravo to you for creating that platform. And we're excited to have you here today. I want to shift gears because you are someone who's very connected to real estate, financial markets, what's going on. I want to ask you, because I think you will have a deep well of knowledge, what's happening in the market today? What's happening with interest rates and residential real estate and commercial real estate? Because there are listeners who are starting to follow along in terms of what's happening in the world. A lot of them, if they're just jumping in, are maybe a little unnerved with where the economy is going and where interest rates are going. So can you give some context and just lay out the landscape for us?
Well, we go through different periods of cycles in the economy. These have been measured and really recorded over, you know, several centuries. And there's really two sets of cycles. There's what I would call the longer secular cycle, which are typically somewhere around 40-ish years, give or take. That's a range. And then we have within these longer periods of time, the secular cycles, we have what we call just the business or market cycle. That's what most people can relate to, because the business or market cycle generally over history, the last, you know, 100 plus years, turns about every 6 to 8 years. That's just on average. And we are, so people understand that the last major one we had was the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. And then coming out of that, for a lot of reasons that we understand, but it's a digital expansion of credit, or people call it printing of money, where the Federal Reserve has been coming in for, you know, decades and, quote, saving the day. And we get away with that because we're the reserve currency of the world, at least for now. So what happens is we go through these cycles, you call them boom bust, right? And the last time we felt a little bit of the bust was during COVID, the spring. And everybody remembers, you know, the steep drop in the financial markets, and it's like everything's falling apart. And then once again, the Fed came to the rescue with not just a few bucks, but I think it's like about $9 trillion. Just play money, yeah. Play money, of course, right? So we go through these cycles, but the secular cycle, I think, is also important to understand within these business cycles. And that's where we went. When I really started real estate was 1980. It was the peak of interest rates for really over many years, many decades in history. The federal funds rate was increased by then federal chairman Paul Volcker, because what was happening? Well, inflation. Inflation had been running hot and heavy in the 70s. It peaked, and then they dropped it back down, and then it peaked again. And you hear a lot of people that get involved in the economic cycle relating, you know, is Jerome Powell, is he a Paul Volcker, or is he an Arthur Burns? Arthur Burns, the one that let the hat out, and Volcker came in to smash it. And smash it he did, taking interest rates, the federal funds rate, up to 20%. And we had back-to-back recessions. Perfect timing for me to jump into the real estate market. But actually it was, because stuff was on sale. No one could buy. So we got a good deal. But back-to-back recessions. And then since then, we've had the declining interest rates from 1980 at the peak all the way down to the bottom, which is virtually exactly 40 years, just by coincidence, in the summer of 2020. And now we've had the inflection back up. Now, I'm not here to predict that it's going to go back to 20%. I don't think that's what we look at. We look at the relative change and the rate of change we've had in the last, it's coming on 2 years. It was 2022 March when Powell finally said we're going to start raising interest rates because this inflation thing is getting out of hand. And so we had the run up until the pause in December. All right, so that's the backdrop. So what would I say to investors who are like, yeah, I always wanted to do this real estate thing, but man, I'm my ears to the ground and I'm hearing like commercial real estate's in trouble. And a lot of real estate, commercial real estate, particularly housing to a lesser extent, but commercial is in some asset classes you could say are free fall, like office, for reasons including COVID and the work from home that occurred. But other asset classes, you tear down, some are in trouble. And what I tell people is that this is normal. This is a cycle. Then they say, well, then what do I do? Just so I just sit back and wait for the fallout? Go, well, no, if you're connected to good people, there are people that are not just financial arbitrage people, but they're actual people who are operators, operators who know what they're doing, actually have operations and have, you know, appropriate amounts of debt and fixed debt, not variable rate debt, can get through these. Because I did it with my own portfolio in several of the down cycles. As long as you have good operations and an asset class that has a, generally speaking, a long duration need, let's just say roof overhead, that usually fits. In this case of self storage, we're all hoarders. So who wants to give up their stuff? I mean, that's the last thing we're going to do is give up our stuff, because that's really important. I know mine is. What's yours? But
life events.
My stuff's really important, so I'm not going to give that up, right? So that's what you have to. I think we have to tell people is it's where you invest. You know how you do it. Are you going to be direct hands on? Most of our people, your pilots and my docs, don't want to be hands on. Okay, next level is all right. Well, then who do you know, or who do you know who knows somebody? what does that look like? Well, then you got to start digging deeper, right, gentlemen? We have to say, well, what's the track record? What's the culture? Who's behind the curtains of some operation, whatever asset class is? And then another part that we really, really are looking at harder now that we really didn't so much in the past, because it's just where we are today, but what are the financial components? I don't mean just the pro forma and the leverage of whatever the fund or syndication is doing, but what is the financial competency or best practices of the actual fund manager or the syndicator, irrespective of the actual investment that they're going to put my money into? Do they actually run a good team of people who actually know what their numbers are? I know we both know that there's well-meaning people out there don't intentionally mean to mess it up. But if you don't know your numbers, the game's over now. The game's over. And now, as Warren Buffett would say, you find out who's been swimming naked as this tide goes out.
Yeah. And, you know, you really kind of hit on, you know, where to put money today. You know, self-storage, roof over your head, fixed rate debt, anything that has like solid fundamentals. Can you kind of expand on that? You know, where should I be putting my money today based on this market cycle that we're in?
What I tell a lot of my docs, and again, I'm not a financial advisor, and I'm not playing one here today at all. Okay, just so we're clear.
We have a disclaimer in the show notes. So
perfect, perfect, perfect. Yeah, come to talk about teeth whitening, and I'll do that all day long. I'm still licensed and incredible. Actually, you like some of us help out for that? Okay, later after the show. So you know, we talk about the capital stack. I know you gentlemen understand that. For people who are listening, go, what is he talking about? It's the layering of how transactions are put together, whether it's it happens on Wall Street, it happens in real estate. But there's basically two aspects to the capital stack. There's what we call equity. And that's what typically people think about when you invest in real estate. It's, I want to own something or own a part of something, because that's where you get the potential value add, the uptick in valuation. That's where you certainly get tax benefits. You get the increase in cash flows as in an inflationary marketplace. Those are what we usually think about with real estate. That's the sexy part of real estate. Okay, but when we go through a market cycle change, maybe that's not so sexy for a time. So I tell people, well, what's the debt side? Now people think, well, debt, David, I don't want debt. No, I'm talking about debt as a liability. When you borrow money from the bank, that's a debt to us, but it's an asset to the bank. Well, we can be or participate like a bank if we care to in the debt part of the capital stack. And I know you guys offer, you know, a debt component to your fund. I tell people that equity investing, the ownership piece, is more about the story. It's the story. There's no real guarantees. It's like, we think this will happen. We think if this and this happens, that we can project that we'll get these returns, but it's a story. The debt side is contractual, meaning that you're going to get some kind of a paper promissory note aspect that says, this is what we're going to pay. It's like a bond. It's a bond, right? It's essentially a bond. And you're not going to get the uptick like you would in an inflationary environment where you have the big value added. You can't get the leverage like you would if you're using proper leverage and the tax benefits, unless you're doing a retirement account, which is a good place for this. But I say there's a time when you take really only what the market gives you. Don't try to force the market to give you something the market can't give you right now. You've got to be patient and ride through it wherever you think your best allocations are. And just know that the market's going to turn again. And there will be a time to maybe flip from more of the debt side of the capital stack back into equities. I have allocations in both sides, no question about it. And as long as I'm with good operators on the equity side, I have no fear. I'm good. But right today, I've got to look really hard at who's bringing equity to the table. What does it make sense today? And it can. Going through the different aspects that you and I, the three of us, would look at, does it check these boxes? Then I might do a play in equity. But for the most part, I say, if you don't know what you're doing, maybe a good place to start is more on the debt side in private credit transactions or with a fund or syndicator who does that, because overall, you're probably safer in that part right now.
I love this conversation. I actually have a thread going on right now on my LinkedIn about this, where we're in this market where being in common equity, as you suggested, isn't really going to produce you a lot of cash flow necessarily, because, you know, the interest rates are super high and the cap rates are low. And the reality is, this negative leverage environment that we're in, real estate's held its value really well, which is a great thing for a real estate investor. But interest rates have exceeding, you know, cap rates is creating, this is a longer conversation, but it's basically making it very difficult to cash flow, because now you need a bigger down payment on a property and at a higher interest rate. And now you have more equity to spread that cash on cash return to. And so I think it's well taken, you know, in the capital stack when you say, hey, equity and debt, you can be a lender, you can be an owner, essentially. And the owner goes along with the story of the deal and the debt is contractual. I love that. It's important right now because if you really, you got to think about, you know, whenever I ask that question, you know, where should I put my money? It's like, well, what do you really want? Do you want a guaranteed cash flow? Nothing's guaranteed, but, you know, the closest thing contractually to it. Or do you want more upside potential? And, you know, I like to think of like a barbell strategy where you have some debt that's producing you income and cash flow, and you have some equity that, hey, if the deal hits it out of the park, or maybe we are in a discounted environment, you know, we won't really know until hindsight, right? We might be at the bottom. We might be not even close to the bottom right now, right? So you're kind of taking that risk, you know, for hopes of future upside. But the debt side, I think, is a great strategy if you want to replace income, you know, almost immediately with what you invest into the deal. So Tate, I know you wanted to jump in, so go ahead, Tate.
I do. So I've got a couple things that I want to touch on here. First, I love that analogy that the equity is, you know, you're the owner. The debt piece is contractual. So I want to further explain that for the listeners. So if you're buying a house, just for someone who might not be quite following along here or wants to really flesh out the concept here, if you're buying a house and you're thinking of the down payment, right? You're putting 20% down, you're buying $1 million house, you need $200,000 down. Well, the bank is providing a loan for the other $800,000. And you over time are chipping away at that loan and you own more and more of that real estate. Now, if that house goes up to $1.3 million in value, you own all of that $300,000 of equity appreciation, right? The bank doesn't magically own some of that long-term appreciation, right? That all belongs to you. So you have not increased your, you know, $1 million to $1.3 million is a 30% increase in value. But you remember, you only put $200,000 down. And now you've got $300,000 of additional equity. So you went from 200 to 500. You've 2.5 times your money. That is the power of leverage. Now, that's on the upside where it's great to be in equity. If you're on the debt side, while you're not getting the benefit of the appreciation, you are in a more secure position if things don't go well. So remember, the loan amount on that $1 million property was $800,000. If the property goes down to, say, $900,000 valuation, first of all, don't freak out. You know, we hold real estate for the long term, like, you know, you can ride out the storm. But if you were to sell that, the bank still owns $800,000 and you would be left with only $100,000. So you protect yourself in a downside situation. And the smaller the loan to value ratio is, then the more protected you are. Because if you're at, let's say the loan is secured by the property and it's a 50% loan to value. So it's a $500,000 loan on $1 million of value. That property would have to come down by 50% in value just for the bank to be even Stevens, right? And they're always going to have they're in first position. That's what first position loan means, is they're in first position to collect should you stop paying your monthly payments. It's a contractual term. And if you stop paying, they're going to take the asset because it's collateralized, that the loan is collateralized by the property. So I just wanted to interject that to flesh out that concept a little bit more and build that knowledge base. We're actually looking to launch a debt product as well this year. Ryan, I know you've had a debt fund for many years now. David, it sounds like you invest in debt. I've invested in Ryan's debt fund. We'd like to launch one this year. So can I ask in a public forum, what are the things that you look for in a debt fund? We talk about equity all the time on this show. What are the things that you look for underlying in a debt fund to provide that security and that cushion?
Well, we're going to start with what are the operators? What are the assets that the debt fund is providing capital to? I was talking to an operator earlier today who similarly is creating a debt fund, and they are going to use the capital in that debt fund to do hard money lending. Okay, I'm not saying that's good or bad. You have to dig deeper. My concern would be, okay, well, what does that look like? Because I'm not right now thinking I'm a big fan in general of a lot of fix and flippers right now for the reasons we know. So I'm not saying it will work or won't work, but where are we lending the money, or where are you, right? Where's my money going?
The reason I'm asking this is because I want to call attention to the fact that if anybody sees a debt fund out there and they think, oh, it's debt, great, it's secure, It's safe. It's a contractual guaranteed rate. You know, I'm going to make 8% on this and I don't have to worry about anything else. It's not necessarily the case. You need to look deeper and see who, you know, how are we producing that 8% return, right? So sorry, David, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no, you're fine. That's always the key. You said it is contractual. It's first money out. Well, if it's a first position, there's funds that may be putting the money into a second position or mezzanine debt for people. You think about the floor up from the base floor of a hotel, the mezzanine is the next level up. So that's second position debt. That's going to, you know, theoretically earn a higher rate of return. So that can look good on paper. Well, we're lending money, but again, it's all in the details. And I think this is where investors have to dig in and gain a greater understanding of exactly where the money's going, how it's going to make that money. Because even though it's contractual, if the money's not there, that fund could die a painful death, and
right,
still could, just like a bond fund. If there's no money to pay, then yeah, you could be a bondholder. But what's the assets, and are you going to go take those assets? And typically, in a fund or something, you're not going to be in that position.
Right.
Well, that's great. You know, you've got so much experience, and looking back over the last 25, 30 years of doing this. I mean, what are some lessons learned? Where have you gotten burned? What can you share with our listeners on, you know, things that may have happened that you wish you would have known today?
Well, the first thing I would say is that stay with what you know. And I'll just give a little story about that. But this was 2004, 2005. So I'd been, you know, doing my own real estate potentially for 25 years and was feeling, you know, pretty good. Things were going pretty well overall for me. And I met somebody who, with good intentions, not a fraudulent person, but was kind of a capital raiser for the oil and gas industry. Okay. Well, you guys know what I'm talking about. We have a good friend in oil and gas. So I'm not saying negative to oil and gas, but the drilling aspect. This was oil shale fracking back in an environment that was west of where I am in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, is Barnett Shale. Big, big geological development. And it was going big gangbusters back then. And this well-intentioned person just said, man, David, you got to get in on this. And by the way, here's the key words. He said, it's so good, I'm putting my parents' money in it. Well, you hear that and go, okay, I'm in. It's good enough for your parents. It's got to be good enough for me. And basically, lawsuits played out everywhere and capital calls, meaning to keep the thing going, the operators were saying, if you're an investor with us, we need more capital. And I just said, I'm out. So I dropped about $300,000 back there in that. So I didn't know anything about it. And that was the problem. I knew real estate, and not that real estate's perfect, but I got out of my lane. So that was the lesson back then. So I've just not deviated. If I'm going to deviate, I've got to dig in all the way and really know what I'm talking about and who I'm talking to. That's the key here. If you're starting something new, really got to find the people who are not just there to sell you something, because they think it's good, or maybe they just need the money and they're just trying to sell anything they've got. You've got to be really careful about that and not get caught up in trends or fads, which that certainly was a fleeting one there. The other lesson is really, as we and I have become more passive in my investing, which is where I want to be, probably looking, as I said earlier, about the second piece of due diligence. Well, there's three pieces. There's the operator, background check, track record. Second piece is, what's the legal and structural formation of the fund or syndication you're putting money into? In other words, do you understand it, or somebody helped you understand exactly what the flow of funds are and where you sit in the capital stack, et cetera, what that all looks like? And the third thing that where I have been remiss, and that is looking at the financial capability of the operator. Again, with all good intentions and maybe a good asset class, but are they keeping track of the numbers and running a good best practices in-house or outside? Or do they have bookkeepers, CPA, controller? I mean, what does that look like? And I'm not saying you have to go all the way to the top, but it depends upon, you know, the operator. But as somebody looked at that, that's not me. I know a little bit about numbers, but I'm not a financial guy where I can go in and look at someone's books and tell you if it's good, bad, or ugly. It's just not my area of expertise. So do you have somebody on your team, on your side, that can help you look at some of those things? I think right now is a really important time to not drop the ball on any of those particular aspects.
That's great.
Love that.
You know, I guess one of my last questions, you know, as we wrap up, and I wanted to thank you, David, for coming on and sharing your insights and wisdom. My final question I always like to ask is, you know, what What in the last 6 months have you, I mean, you've been in this for a long time, but what in the last 6 months have you learned that is something that sort of really has changed your trajectory or really adjusted your way of thinking? Or what's kind of resting heavy on your mind in the last 6 months?
I think for myself, not that I've seen it all, I've gone through enough cycles that nothing surprises me anymore. Sometimes it's just coming back and just revealing what you knew, but didn't put into place. But I think for me, because I feel not a fiduciary responsibility, but I feel very much that I really want to be the best advocate for the people that I'm trying to serve without being a financial advisor.
A good steward.
So good steward. Thank you. And so what I try to do is be very, very upfront about what I see and try to reduce the exuberance and euphoria that we've all seen in the last few years and just try to reduce the expectations. Because again, it seems like everybody that I see wants to chase yield. Gotcha. Well, where's the highest return I can get? Can you get me a IRR, internal rate of return of, you know, high teens and 20s and like we saw in the last few years, because everybody was hitting those home runs, right? Well, where is that today? Well, I got to go find that. And I say, no. This is not a time to be chasing yield. It's a time for patience and more discernment and wait until the time's right to perhaps seek those kind of returns again when the market provides that for us.
Wisdom. I love that. We're very much aligned in our thinking. That's been definitely. I mean, you see so many, you know, I get investors all the time that send me people's OMs and they say, hey, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, I mean, I get it. The returns are really good and all that. But I mean, really, I mean, this is a market that's tough. You know, cap rates are still low. Interest rates are still high. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And, you know, just the glamour and the glitz, you know, and it seems like people continue to keep selling that. And it's alarming. So thank you for sharing that. Go ahead, Tate.
And I'll just tack on to that with, you know, I have always found, including myself in my earlier years, that retail investors are typically very poor at identifying and accounting for risk. You know, the returns are just a projection, and they're projections that are based on specific set of assumptions. And those assumptions have to become true in order for those projections to become true. And so what we always talk about is risk-adjusted returns. It's like, how much risk do you have to take in order to get X amount of return? And, you know, we are always looking for those asymmetric opportunities where there's not a whole lot of risk for, and it might be, you know, 8, 9, 10% return, but if it's a very low risk profile and we have a very high probability of hitting those numbers, well, I want to do that all day. So I don't care if it's a 50% annualized return, if the chances of getting it are very low, then your risk-adjusted return, basically multiplying the potential return by the probability that it will actually happen.
Exactly.
Well, David, how do people get in touch with you? What's the best way to connect and learn more about what you do?
Well, like you gentlemen, I have a blog post and a podcast, the Dentist Freedom Blueprint podcast. You don't have to be a dentist, but I'll make you an honorary one if you want to jump in, learn about your teeth while you learn how to invest money. But
yes.
I do similar to what you do. You do it for pilots, I do it for dentists, but like everybody's welcome, right? Because we're talking about stuff that a lot of people want to know about. The website for those who are interested, it's freedomfounders.com. I've got a few books on Amazon that speak to different aspects of investing and, you know, how to make money work. So those are always available for people to take care.
Well, we'll link to all of those in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on, David.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming.
Yeah. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation today.